Hey everybody, this is Operating Systems. Just get everything set. Yeah. And as I said, the rest of the course is Operating Systems, Networks and Architectures. Today and probably on Wednesday, we will put some light on operating systems, how they relate to architectures, and what you need to know as bare minimum about your operating system. Operating system is something that you are very familiar with because you're sitting in front of it and you're using it every day on tons of different devices. Let's narrow down a little bit more what it could actually mean. Before I dive into that one, any concerns about the course, about your progress? Are you still relaxed? If that is possible, so close to the end of the semester. As I posted on the forums, if you are in distress of any sort, please contact us. Okay. Writing design documents is hard. Thanks for that comment. It is, for many of us, a challenge because many of us are a bit more on the nerdy side and we enjoy to produce stuff which blinks and works and does something. Very well understood and I completely sympathize. Having said so, there is something which many of you still, I think, have to acquire, and that is the pleasure and the satisfaction of writing a beautiful document. It is as professional as writing excellent and beautiful code. If you look at a document and say, this is my technical report and it's beautiful, it's really nice. That is a level which many students will not see in the first one, two semesters at all. They just get it done and they feel it's just an awkward kind of essay exercise. But they don't take the pride in a beautiful report. And once you actually get to a technical level of writing a report, it's not an essay. A technical report is quite different. And you can learn those skills similar to the skills how to write beautiful and nice code, how to write beautiful and nice technical documents. Getting to that level is important for your future development and also for your well-being, because if you hate writing reports now, you will hate writing reports possibly for the rest of your life. That's not a good starting point. You will need to write a lot of them later on, probably more than you have to write code. And that's make the best out of it and actually take this as a professional challenge. And then you will take benefit out of that. Cool. So no three. No. A sense of humor is highly appreciated. So communicating with your reader in a sensible way can include having a little bit of humor into your reports as well. I know that's not meant that serious, your comment here, but it's actually okay to do that. Maybe not in the description of your technical manual for your CPU, you probably want to joke around in that, but if you describe your design, your motivations, your path going there, doesn't have to be an adventure story, but it can be. Okay, this is not what the skills which you need to actually write good technical reports. Good technical reports just have to be something well you can be proud of in the end. So, had no time for the design document. Well, that's just bad time planning. Because the design document has to not come at the very end, but has to come during your development. And you should not just put this as an afterthought into your design. It should become an integral part of your design. This is also part of your professional development, that you make this a part of it and not just as a add-on, attached, glued-on, sticky-taped, little embarrassing extension. No? Okay. Will assignment 3 be more difficult than assignment 1 and 2? Yes, of course. Assignment 3 is close to impossible. Assignment 3 will be very, very, very difficult. What exactly do you want me to say? It will follow on from the assignment 1 and assignment 2. So the complexity will, of course, be increasing because you're more skilled by now. But it is on a similar level as what you have done for assignment 1 and 2. It is not going to be more time-consuming, if you ask that. Okay. All right. Further questions on the forums or directly to me. Always personal messages or emails if you have any stress which you want me to consider, have a look at, advice, etc. So let's get back to operating systems. Just bring that on. So, let's start from here. I painted a few logos of operating systems on this slide. What you should notice here is that you will know a few operating systems. Take note, there are a lot more of them. And yes, you have seen the operating systems on your phone and on your laptop. Beyond that, have you seen the operating systems which are running, I don't know, in your car? Because they will hopefully not be macOS or Windows or Linux. Hopefully there will be something which is more suited for the job. And there is a much wider variety of operating systems than what you see directly as an end consumer. Cool. You can blue screen your car, I hope not. We talk about this in a moment. Okay, but let me get back to that in a moment. First of all, what is an operating system, how we can define that? And there are two main approaches how to describe and define an operating system. One definition is an operating system is just simply a virtual machine. Why do you call it a virtual machine? You have seen the interface to your CPU, to your hardware. That's one way of interfacing with the machine. Right? And then you can abstract from this architecture interface, from this hardware interface, to something which is a bit more comfy, maybe a bit more reliable, a bit safer, doesn't allow so many mistakes. And so you design a virtual machine on top of the machine which you currently have, so that you can do memory management and accessing the hardware in a slightly more comfortable way than flipping individual bits on some device registers and give you more safety and comfort in the process. How large are these virtual machines? Big, big differences. This is what you're familiar with. The operating system which you have on your laptops and sometimes even on your phones are absolutely gigantic compared to what you have running on top of them. In most cases, you have your little, not if you run Chrome, okay, fine. If you have your little browser there or your little email client, this is absolutely tiny compared to the size, the sheer volume of your operating system. This is many gigabytes these days, what you have to install on your laptop or desktop to call it an operating system. Right? So this is the picture which you have there usually. But operating systems do not need to be gigantic. Putting out another example, if you look at typical real-time systems, then the real-time operating system is usually really slim, really tiny, And the tasks which are running on that are significantly bigger than the actual operating system. The operating system is also very docile and passive. It is not utilizing your CPU without you doing anything in the background. So it's more predictable as well. I'll talk about this in a moment as well. And there's also this form of hardware abstraction, this form of virtual machine, which is what is usually called a runtime environment, not really an operating system. It's a runtime environment, which comes with your programming language or with your library or with your environment in general. And some of your compilers can just compile the whole runtime environment into your binary code. So you compile your program, and what comes out on the other side is not one of those tasks, but what comes out on the other side is this whole green area, including a runtime environment. And then you transport the binary, which comes out of your compiler, bare bone on the CPU, on an embedded system, on a piece of hardware. And it runs without any further installation of an operating system. This is the other form of abstracting from the hardware just by utilizing a higher level programming language to do all of that for you. Does that make sense? Wouldn't virtual machines have performance losses? Well, hopefully not. You try to increase the safety and comfort. And good computer science is all about increasing reliability without sacrificing performance. Can this be done? Yes. I have to be careful. Right? It's easily spoiled. And if you stack virtual machines on top of each other, you have one emulator on top of another emulator, you will almost automatically lose performance in the process. But if you do that cleverly, you can keep the same performance as if you would deal with that directly. It's just giving you the safety of what you would have done manually in assembly by hand is now generated for you in a more safe and predictable way. For example, you want to share variables somewhere, and you know that you need some synchronization mechanism, some locks or semaphores or something like that to achieve that. And you can do this by hand, use memory reservation, programming assembly, or use a higher level programming language which does that for you and translate that for you in a safer way so that you cannot make mistakes in terms of putting the wrong reservation in the wrong spot or the wrong semaphore operation in the wrong spot. But it doesn't lose performance. And so if it's done well, you will not lose performance in the process. It's a good comment, though. Is that the stack? You mean the picture here? No. This picture is just a depiction of a virtual machine, so something which sits on top of the hardware. The operating system works directly on the hardware, your tasks interfacing with the operating system. This is not a stack. Right? This is just a hierarchy of something interacting and interfacing to the next layer below. It's just a layered design. Right? Abstraction levels, different layers, top layer interacts with the lower layer, interacts with the next layer, etc. Okay. And this is also not a separation in space or memory or CPUs, because as we have seen, the operating system components are running on your CPU exactly the same way as your tasks are running on the CPU. So this is an abstraction in terms of software interfaces. Okay. Runtime environment means compiler. Runtime environment means usually what is produced by your compiler or what is embedded by your compiler. A runtime environment is something which is necessary to run your program. You can run your program on top of an existing operating system on your laptop, for example. This is what you usually do, right? But if you don't have an operating system and your language is strong enough to be able to produce a runtime environment as part of the binary which comes out of the compiler, then you can use that as well. Okay. So do the performance of these three examples range from high to low? Slow and careful. In practice, this is... So there is not necessarily an automatic reduction in performance when you use these different approaches here. Not by the size of this you can conclude to the performance. If you assume that this is your laptop operating system, and this is a runtime, a real-time operating system, performance is defined very differently for these things. Performance here is defined by how reliable can you watch a video. Performance here is defined by how predictable will the responses in the real physical world be. That's differently defined. This is similar to the other ones. This is just a different way of designing that. So this is not really a comment on performance. Okay. What's the difference between a general operating system and a real-time operating system? I will come back to that question. So runtime environments is also an operating system. You could look at it like this. Usually it's not. Usually a runtime environment is called a runtime environment. An operating system is called an operating system. An operating system is more universal. An operating system does not discriminate by programming languages, for example, or specific needs for the specific task. The runtime environment here is tailored specifically to what this task needs. So it can be much smaller in size, and it can be also very language dependent, because if those tasks here are written in Python, for example, the runtime environment needs to be radically different compared to if those tasks here are written in C++. Right? So these runtime environments are reflecting the immediate needs of those tasks. Operating systems are usually agnostic of that. Operating systems are catering for all kinds of needs for different languages and different tasks. Okay. So that's one way of looking at an operating system. The second traditional way of looking at an operating system, instead of a virtual machine, is an operating system is a resource manager, coordinating access to the hardware resources. Can look at it like that. Because what you need from the perspective of your programming language is, I can execute instructions, right? I can run a loop. Don't need an operating system for that. My for loop is just executing on the CPU directly anyway. I don't need an operating system for that. But you do need an operating system if you want to allocate new memory, if you want to interact with the internet. Right? For that, you need an operating system, so the operating system provides you with access to the hardware resources and a coordinated access to the hardware resources. What are those hardware resources which the operating system will sign responsible for? The CPUs, so access to them. When do you get access to them? Who is getting access to those CPUs? How memory is allocated, distributed, deallocated, managed, protected? Access to mass storage, which means your SSDs or your swinging Rust drives, all your communication channels, and all the other devices which are around that. So this is another way of looking at it, not as a new machine, which has different abstraction levels, but just as a way of accessing your resources. Ultimately, it's the same thing. It's just a different way of looking at the same thing called an operating system or runtime environment. So now to your questions. What's the difference between real-time operating system and normal operating system? There are different kinds of operating systems. I would like to go into that in a second. Before I do that, let me give you a little bit a historical overview where operating systems have been coming from. And operating systems have not been in existence from the get-go in computer science. They came a little later, actually. In the very early days, there was no such thing as an operating system. There was basically all direct runtime environments and a bunch of libraries, and you have compiled something and directly ran this on the CPU. There was no further operating system in between. Then you had a little bit more comfort in terms of interfacing interrupts, and support of memory protection came into the 50s and 60s, last century, long time ago. Then you had multi-programming systems so that you could actually run multiple programs on the same CPU, but they could not communicate yet with each other at all. It was just providing the illusion of having multiple computers, but they could not communicate in any way. This is called multi-programming. Then multi-programming, which could actually emulate that something happens simultaneously. Time-sharing systems. Those were the old mainframe interfaces. And this is where it becomes interesting. In the early 70s, the first so-called multitasking systems have been introduced. And one of the examples is, of course, Unix, but there are other examples which have been developed in the 70s for multitasking operating systems, which means you can run multiple programs, multiple tasks at the same time, and they can interact, they can share stuff, they can communicate. So that was a big breakthrough and was the foundation of what you have as operating systems today. Let me stop for that for a moment. Then you have a very, very different direction emerging in the 80s of last century, which were single-user, single-tasking systems. All the multitasking stuff was out the window on these systems. If you ever heard of MS-DOS, CPM, the old-style macOS, etc., they were all single-tasking systems. And the emphasis here changed completely because they introduced something which none of these operating systems had, namely a user interface, which was more than a blinking cursor on your screen. And only in the 80s we have then slowly integrated these things into slightly more modern systems, and we have started to have actual multiprocessor, multi-core operating systems starting in the 80s, and also distributed operating systems, which could actually run over multiple machines as a uniform operating system. Cool. Is there a good course which covers the history in more depth, specifically hardware breakthroughs that led to all that? Well, I'm sure the operating systems course itself will actually shed some more light on that. So we do have a course called Operating Systems that will probably give you a little bit more insight. Other than that, I have a tendency myself to give you some historic examples in all of my courses every once in a while. We don't really have a history course as such at the ANU for computer science. It's an interesting idea to actually have a history of computer science course. What was used before we had an operating system? Bare bone running code. So your compilers, if you even had compilers, if you didn't write it directly in assembly, you were just creating, initially people were just writing in assembly directly and executing that code, end of story, just what you're doing now. And then they used higher-level programming language. It also produced that code, which was directly running on the CPU with very little support for anything else but bare memory management and a little bit of device interfaces. Okay. Should the second early 60s be late 60s, or is early 60s there twice? No, that's actually early 60s twice. That's correct. Both of these things happened there. And they're slightly different directions. What's the relationship between Linux and Unix? Unix is the general name for all Unix-style operating systems. I will come back to that today as well. Linux is an open-source implementation based on x86 originally of an open-source version of a Unix operating system, because all other Unix-style operating systems at that time were proprietary and were owned by somebody. So you need to actually buy them. And Linux was the free open source re-implementation of basic Unix concepts. I'll come to that in some more detail a little later. So now, more interesting than the historical excursion is, what are the different types of operating systems? What do you have on a personal machine? On your own laptops, on your own desktop? Operating systems which are working on what earlier was called workstations or personal computers of some sort. And that also had Unix on them in the 70s. And simultaneously, then a little later in the 80s, you had operating systems which are a lot less stable and less multitasking capable, but actually provided something like a user interface. What you had with the early Windows versions and the early macOS versions. It was a breakthrough in a different direction, not in a technical direction of being more safe and more comfortable, as from the perspective of an operating system, but actually providing a user-capable interface. What you have overall, over the last, say, 20 years here, you have a whole bunch of operating systems which are dominating the main market today. For end-user machines, you exclusively find Windows and macOS machines. Linux for desktop, Linux for desktop purposes basically doesn't exist anymore, besides very few people like some of your peers here use Linux as a desktop operating system. Linux is mostly used as a server operating system these days, not for end users on personal computers, at least not to any kind of scale. So if you take percentages worldwide, you will find that everything is Windows or macOS these days. There's nothing else left, which is not necessarily great, but this is what we have. And you also see that the development of operating systems has been moving away a lot from academia and from universities, and they are completely controlled, at least from the desktop and laptop perspective, By multinational companies instead of by initiatives by academia. It was different at some phase where the drivers for operating system development were coming more from academia than they're actually coming today. Multiprocessing, including multi-core operations, are supported by all of these operating systems to some extent. At the same time, none of these operating systems, which you see here, are actually suitable for embedded systems or for real-time systems or for distributed systems. You have to be a little bit more careful if you need operating systems for those purposes. None of these operating systems are lending themselves for those kind of environments. Yes, I know some attempts have been made to use, for example, Windows and Linux for embedded systems. They are, put it diplomatically, semi-successful. So, exactly, somebody has seen the Windows version there. What embarrasses me a little bit is to say here for the last 20 years, because this is basically, you have never seen anything else. That's what I'm saying here. And I would be much happier if I could say that, well, oh, last year this and that has been introduced. 10 years ago, this one has been discovered and introduced. New operating systems, at least in the end consumer market, are non-existent. From your perspective, they existed from forever until now. And they're constantly morphing and evolving, but nobody is really rocking the boat in coming up with something radically new, at least not for the desktop market, which has reasons of compatibility, understood, But at some point, you probably come into this business from the perspective of, there is so much innovation there. Things are changing every day and every year. If you look at the operating systems which you have on your machine, not that fast, not that much. Okay. Does it mean some general operating systems can also be used for embedded or real-time systems? No, it means the opposite. These general operating systems cannot be used for embedded or real-time operating systems, at least not if you take any of these requirements serious. You can try to do that if your emphasis is you really, really want to have your tasks which are running on Windows somewhat running on an embedded system, then it may be a productive direction, but you lose a lot of the other features which you need for embedded systems if you do something like that. More on that a little later. So what's a driver roughly? Is this a user interface or something? No, a driver is simply a way to interact with devices. It is giving you a slightly higher abstraction to interact with a physical device. So usually it's called a device driver. A driver for your trackpad or for your mouse, which abstracts from the physical interface so that you can easily interact with it. So in that sense, it's a one layer on top of the physical interaction, which makes it easier for you. Usually you're not directly interacting with the driver interface. The driver interface is used by the operating system, and then the operating system is providing some interface for you. Okay. Why Linux doesn't always need driver? Don't quite understand that question. It's unfortunate how monopolized the PC industry has become. They're usually one of the options for a piece of hardware and software. Indeed, I mean, it limits diversity, that you are reduced to what the handful of dominating multinational companies will actually provide to you, which could be great. But if it doesn't fit your bill and you want something a little bit different, the variety has been shrinking quite a bit. A lot of small companies have been needing to close shop, and you feel that as small newcomers will have less of a chance these days to do something like that. Okay. Any further comments on why Linux doesn't always need a driver? A question which I don't quite understand as such. People have tried to make new stuff, just no one buys it. Sure, it's a two-edged sword, of course, to come up with something which can directly compete with an operating system which has been fine-tuned and involved for literally 20 years, because the current Windows systems and the current macOS systems are going back to designs pretty closely to the year 2000. And it is, of course, hard to come up with something that give you that. Hardware in Linux doesn't need to install drivers compared to Windows. No, that's a bit of an illusion, because Windows usually rubs it in your face if it wants to install a new driver. Linux is either already coming with these drivers built in, or they're actually downloading these drivers without telling you. No, it's not that Linux doesn't need drivers. All hardware interfaces need drivers, or you need to actually do it yourself. Imagine you buy a new interface, a new trackpad of some sort, and then you get a little 200-page manual with that, which explains to you that those memory addresses, those registers, will actually do this and that on your trackpad. Good luck. This would be a device coming without a driver, right? So you always will have some kind of a driver interface for that. Da, 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 da. definitely need a lot of drivers. The situation is more like in Linux, it can be sometimes hard to find the driver because some hardware manufacturers, if you think at graphics cards, for example, will provide fairly elaborate drivers for Windows and hopefully for macOS sometimes, and then they usually stop. And if you are wanting to use the latest graphics cards on Linux, good luck. It can be extremely hard to find the latest drivers for Linux there, if there will ever be some for some of these cards. Okay, good. I think we covered that. I think that's more comments and questions. So let's look at some other operating systems, because you are familiar with those, right? You're familiar with what runs on your laptop and what that can do. You all are super experts on Windows and macOS or Linux, right? You're not so much expert on these. There are things which are called parallel operating systems. Operating systems which are not supportive just for 3, 8, 12 cores, but for a few thousand of them. And they can come in a symmetrical form or an asymmetrical form. And that some operating systems are carrying the full operating systems, others only small stubs of them. Or all operating systems have a full copy of that, but they are needing to communicate and adjust and synchronize very carefully to get everything done. So operating systems which are from the get-go designed to run highly parallel, to execute your threads on thousands of parallel cores at the same time. That's not macOS. That's not Linux either. So that need to be something a little different. And closely related to that is something which is called distributed operating systems. That means that not all of your CPUs necessarily need to carry the whole operating system, but I don't know, some device drivers like your spinning Rust or SSD interfaces need to only be existent on some of your CPUs. Many other CPUs, a few other thousands of them, never ever need to have a hard drive driver installed, and they can only have a bunch of other services. They're only maybe only needing memory management locally on them. So distributed operating systems are also capable of distributing the different aspects of an operating system over many different cores in your system or many different processors. Okay, so those are two different directions, parallel and distributed operating systems, for which you need more concurrent systems background to go into those, and those are things which you would install on supercomputers classically or in load balancing environments, high redundancy, hot standby environments where you need the reliability of something explodes, something burns, and something else jumps on in their place right away. That's not necessarily a supercomputer. It can be many other devices which need just that. Every time where you cannot afford that a single failure will kill your system, there you need more distribution. Okay. So that brings me to another area which we already scratched, namely real-time operating systems. Let me start defining real-time operating systems, which what people usually tell you what real-time operating systems may be. Fast context switches. Small size, super responsive to external interrupts, can do multitasking, has low-level stuff in it, has inter-process communication tools, and has high processor utilization. What do you think? Let me just come back to that for a moment. Let me just finish the real-time operating system first. What do you think of that characterization for real-time operating systems? Does high processor utilization mean low downtime? It means that your CPU is running full blast. Sounds exciting. Quick response is true. None of that is true. This is all rubbish. None of this has any relation to real time. Fast context switches. As opposed to what? As opposed to purposefully slow context switches? Small as opposed to purposefully big? Quick. Never quick. Real time has nothing to do with quick. Real time has something to do with predictable. You don't want to be able to switch on your indicators as quickly as possible. You want to have your indicators actually blinking in a reasonable and sensible pattern. You don't want to slam your brakes and open your brakes as fast as you can for your ABS system. You want to do this in a sensible and predictable way. So quick is never a feature for real-time operating systems, but predictable. Multitasking, sometimes they have multitasking, sometimes they don't. Low level, you need this in all operating systems. And you can access your devices and your hardware. Inter-process communication tools, you need this in all operating systems. High process utilization, that's the opposite end of real-time operating systems. That's actually bad. Because if all of your CPUs are running pedal to the metal, where is the redundancy coming from? The safety is coming from. Fault tolerance usually builds on the existence of redundancy. If anything happens, you have some extra resources to fall back onto. If all of your resources are flawed at all times, anything goes bad, you're out of resources. So, no, none of these things have anything to do with real-time operating systems, regardless what people tell you. I very often see this quick responses to external interrupts that makes a real-time operating system. Certainly not. That's not the point of a real-time operating system. Okay. What's the meaning of the picture in the background with the Titan, which I had the previous one here? That's a classical supercomputer by the name Titan. So just search for that and you will get more details what the Titan supercomputer, not this year's model, but still pretty impressive piece of hardware. So, what's the difference between parallel operating systems and distributed operating systems? Parallel means it emphasizes on doing things hardware parallel. So the emphasis on parallel operating systems is to have thousands of things happening in lockstep, hardware parallel, simultaneous, exactly at the same time, possibly even synchronized. Right? This is a parallel operating system which emphasizes on that. Distributed means that, it could also mean hardware parallel, but distributed means that I have different features in different CPUs. I distribute the functionality of my operating systems over many pieces of hardware, over many CPUs. Okay. Distributed and parallel, except parallel, yeah, I just think we had this. Can you say the definition of the real-time operating system? Again, I haven't said it yet, so I cannot say it again, but I can't say it at all. This is what actually a real-time operating system is. A real-time operating system gives you, hopefully, what a standard operating system gives you, namely that the logical correctness of the results is okay, but also a correctness of time when the results are being delivered. And that correctness of time means exactly on time, not too early, not too late. Right? It has to be predictable inside a very precisely described time frame. And that predictability makes a real-time operating system. You need this time frame, this not too early, not too late feature of a real-time operating system much more desperately than anything which has anything to do with fast or performant. You want to have your flight surfaces deflecting at the right time, not as fast as you can. You want to turn your steering wheel in your remotely controlled or autonomous car at the right time, at the right speed, not as fast as you can, not as quick as you can. So the quick feature is mostly irrelevant. It is not about performance and fast. This is when you buy faster CPUs, not when you equip your system with a real-time operating system. Real-time operating systems give you predictability. Okay. So that's the main feature of the whole thing. Real-time operating systems also are often fairly passive or completely passive, which means for the sake of predictability, they don't run their own hobbies in the background. Your laptop operating system, as you look at it right now, how many processes and tasks are running when you just lift your hands up? You don't touch the thing at all. Exactly. Dozens. Dozens of processes and tasks are just running constantly in the background, keeping everything happy, interacting with your devices, interacting with your graphics card, with your network, etc. And they're constantly using CPU time without you actually running anything which you would have instantiated yourself. Real-time operating systems are usually more passive in that sense. They only do what you ask them to do. They don't have any daemons, are they usually called, any background tasks for themselves. That's another common feature of real-time operating systems, that they don't utilize CPU time without you instantiating those. Okay, done that. Predictability means reliability. No, they're two different terms. Predictability and reliability are two different things. Reliability means how close a system is to your specifications. So a highly reliable system will, in so-and-so many cases, hopefully 100%, but say in 95%, 99% of the cases, stick to the specifications. This is a highly reliable system. Predictable has something to do with time. Predictability means that you can predict at what specific time something can happen. And the real-time operating system gives you that feature. You can predict exactly what happens when. Reliability is something which applies to any kind of operating system, hopefully. And it just means how far are you diverging from your specifications? How close are you to your specifications? Okay. Then why Windows 10 is not a real-time operating system? I think it meets the requirements. In terms of it's completely predictable that you get a blue screen. Did I get that right? Okay. Yeah, I meant predictable in something which you actually enjoy having predicted rather than something which happens almost certainly, but you didn't want it. So... what's the typical use case scenario of real-time systems? Good questions. Real-time systems is required. Real-time operating systems are required anytime when the timing of your operations are crucial for your application. So if you want to control something in physical space, for example, in real time, in physical space, then the time at which something happens is apparently fairly crucial. As I said, it is making a big difference when you're actually deflecting those rudders here, whether you deflect them at the same time, whether you deflect one of them a second before the other one, is very, very crucial and can mean actually literally difference between life and death, because some of these physical systems are also carrying people or are very closely operating, operating closely to people. So if they're physically crashing, that also could mean endangering human life or endangering environments. So this is where you have real-time operating systems. Every time you need to predict when something needs to happen at a specific time. This is not only these aviation systems of some sort. This is happening in many devices around you these days. Your home automation systems sometimes will require actually real-time systems usually they're not that critical, and more or less 1 second, more or less, is not so critical in your home automation system. But if you have a device which is more critical to that, you will need something like that. Imagine you would like to automate a train system, a subway system. All subway systems on this planet are programmed based on very hard real-time operating systems, on very hard real-time programming languages. You won't find any kind of a Linux Windows environment and a Python program if you want to control a subway car. So those are some typical cases for real-time systems. And I would like to blend over to embedded systems. Embedded operating systems usually actually are real-time operating systems, but they don't necessarily have to be real-time operating systems. Sometimes it's not that required. Embedded operating system means more that there is very little user interaction. It is mostly a few buttons which you have on the device. There's no big screens and menus and trackpads around that. It is to control the device based on a handful of instructions. And those embedded operating systems, which are, as I said, often are actually real-time operating systems, are consuming, hold on to something, 90 to 95% of all the processors on the planet. This is where most of your CPUs are actually employed. And they're running those embedded operating systems, mostly real-time operating systems. So 90 to 95% of your processors will not run your favorite operating systems at all. Excuse me. So, yeah, somebody would, of course, use a subway train with Visual Basic. No question. What's the difference between a real-time operating system and a hard real-time operating system? A hard real-time operating system is defined by how severe are the consequences. So how tough do you have to be with your predictions? How precise do you have to be? Hard real-time operating systems are usually employed in environments where the failure of a single deadline has catastrophic effects. So if the deadline of activating the brakes in your car are violated, hopefully that has been controlled by a hard real-time system. Because if those deadlines are violated and you slam your brake and nothing happens, the effects can be obviously catastrophic. I leave it to your imagination how many systems will have very quickly catastrophic effects and therefore requiring hard real-time environments. So hard means what are the consequences of missing a deadline? Can you afford missing any kind of deadline? So, there is no operating system for embedded systems. No, I meant that these desktop operating systems which you have in front of you, they don't lend themselves for embedded systems. So you cannot run Windows or macOS or Linux in your car, at least not if you want to live. So you need different operating systems for that, and there are operating systems for that. I had them actually on the first slide. A classical one, which is still used everywhere, is VxWorks, for example. It's an operating system which is widely used in industry for real-time operating systems. Okay. More questions? Yep, I think we've done that. There's only a runtime environment. You can have actual real-time operating systems, which are actually operating systems, not just runtime environments. Drone versus passenger plane carrying 300 people. We can all easily design things like that. And they're completely different standards in those industries. So if you design something for safety-critical environments, your software requirements, the requirements for your operating system, for your programming languages, for your compilers, for your hardware devices, for the mounts of your systems, etc., 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 will be on completely different standards. So picking up your phone and your phone crashes is one thing. Expecting a rocket launch sequence to go into the right sequence of operations is something that you should have a little bit more trust in than in your phone. So the OS on our disco board will be classified as an embedded system. If you would have an operating system on it, yes. But you don't have an operating system installed on it. So what does it mean that 90 to 95% of all processors are working there? It means that if you just count the number of CPUs produced by semiconductor manufacturers on this planet and the number of CPUs which are working in your laptops and your desktops is less than 5% of those. Most of these CPUs will go in your toaster, your pocket torch, in your car, in your house automation, in your router maybe. So a lot of these CPUs will work God knows where, but not in your laptops and your desktop machines. That's what that means. Yeah. This is why the automotive industry is most affected by the current semiconductor shortage. Good observation. Okay, let me give you a little bit more of an idea. What systems do you find in your car these days? Let me just give you a little bit of an idea how many different systems you find in a car. Probably in your car too. Maybe not all of them. Don't know how much money you spent for your last car. If it was a 30-year-old student bomb which you took over from the predecessor in your flat for $500, probably not all of them. But if you actually bought a car, say, in the last decade, then most of the things which you see here on the screen will be needing to be implemented in your car. How are they being implemented? With embedded CPUs, with exactly the STM32 or similar processors which you have in front of them. You will find exactly those devices in your car. And for many of these systems which you see here, you need multiple of them. For your brake controllers, you need multiple of them. And for many of these other devices which are actually physically distributed, you need quite a bunch of CPUs for every individual system in your car there. So now you can begin to understand the complexity of these embedded systems. Many of them are actually real-time systems. The operating systems which are running on them, the communication systems which you need to keep all of this synchronized and under control. This will be a really nice car. Actually, if you buy a car today new, it is hard to avoid these. You will actually find pretty much all of these things in pretty much any car you can buy today. So this is becoming quite standard. So these systems become extremely complex. And just to give you an idea how many CPUs you have so many CPUs just in front of you on your laptop. It's not just the 4, 8, 16 CPUs in your core. There are many other embedded systems in your laptop. But so are in your car, in every device which you have around you at home as well. So there are a lot of operating systems in the car rather than just a big one. Yes, absolutely. This is a computer science approach that as a naive computer scientist, you would probably say, oh, this is a lot of tasks. We need a monster CPU to execute all of them so that I can run all of these tasks on one monster CPU and hopefully run my car from that. No engineer in his right mind would ever build a car like that. You would like to have simple, reliable, provable independent devices which do not interfere unless they need to interfere, unless you explicitly put a cable between them. And then they can be proven and verified locally and put a stamp on it, encase them, never touch them again, run them. If you want, for example, design an anti-blocking braking system, which is mandatory in most countries, or an electronic stabilization system, you do not want to run this as one of the many, many tasks combined with your entertainment system and the stuff which switches on the seat heating and the windows going up and down with that, and your automatic windscreen wipers are on the same CPU. No, you want to have them on a separate CPU, verified and proven to be working, and then you don't touch them again and run them independently. So they need a different operating system which is separate from that. Physical distribution and individual local operating systems are vital for that. Does that make sense? What language is usually used for vehicle systems? Good question. You have a lot of cars is a bit funky because as opposed to aviation, there are no international, unified, or even nationally dependable certification requirements on cars. It's basically left to the car manufacturers what they want to do. So they don't have to certify the code which runs in your car unless something really bad happens and the local authority will actually pull you over as a car manufacturer and ask you to please explain why that happened. And that means it's historically grown, and there is a lot of C, C++ working in these environments. And I can elaborate on that a lot further, because I've been spending quite some time in that as well. But it's quite different from other areas where you have more hard real-time languages. You still have hard real-time operating systems in cars these days. I also don't want to put any specific car manufacturer down. I want to scare you entering into a specific car, because as there is no unifying certification authority, ultimately it's left to the car manufacturers how they want to do that. And some of them have very different philosophies than others. Let me leave it at that. Cars. Exactly. A lot of them are proprietary versions of common real-time operating systems. If you want to start from somewhere, look at VxWorks, which is a traditional one. Kind of like braking issues for Teslas in China. Yeah, well, let's not talk about individual car manufacturers here. Some car manufacturers learned the hard way that cutting corners in the development of these individual modules can have disastrous effects on their market. So this is what they're driven by. They're very, very dependent on the reputation of their brand, and this keeps the standard at reasonable levels in car environments, not because of government regulations, because they mostly don't exist for cars. Very different for something like, say, trains or subways or trams, which are heavily constrained and restricted. Okay. If a big operating system controls multiple small operating systems, you want to reduce the amount of interference between your systems to the physical required minimum. And you can, of course, coordinate them in a sensible way, and the communication systems are quite elaborate, which are used in most cars these days. But we'll talk about this when we come to networks, not about operating systems. Okay. Some of these operating systems which you mentioned here are more for, say, Internet of Things kind of interfaces. They are less real-time capable. So what you want to have in a fast-moving device, like in a train or in a car or in an airplane, everything has to be real-time capable. And usually these Internet of Things operating systems are not quite that. Okay, so that means you buy a car today, you will usually have somewhere north of 100 MPUs to be found in your car, to be dug out of your car. And nowadays, some of them are actually pretty high-performant to do that. Engine management, or also motor management, it also goes for electrical motors, can be quite elaborate and can require quite high-performance CPUs today to get these things right and predictable and dependable. Okay. So, is there a standard set of features which defines an operating system? Can I say that operating systems do bum, 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 bum? Not really. As we saw on the previous slides, operating systems covers systems somewhere between some 4 kilobyte sized microkernels, really, really tiny systems, sometimes really tiny real-time embedded systems, or microkernels which are to be found on other devices, or multiple gigabyte installations on your desktop. Obviously, they have a very different feature set. So, no. Is there a minimal feature set? Is operating systems a software? Yes, of course. Do you have a minimum feature set? I'd say almost. I think a minimum feature set I would dare to define for operating systems. I would say operating systems have need to have three features which always need to be there. This is memory management, process management, so the ability to create and destroy tasks, allocate tasks, provide tasks with the resources they need, associate memories with tasks, associate resources with tasks, and some form of inter-process communication or synchronization scheme. I think operating systems, at least if they are actually multitasking operating systems, need to have at least these three features. Interestingly, those are also the three features which are usually named when you want to define what is a microkernel, what is the core basic of your operating system where you cannot compromise any further. This has to be there, and this has to be done by the very core of your operating system. We already answered the question, will there always be an explicit operating system? No, because sometimes the languages which you use will already provide you with a runtime environment without having an explicitly identifiable operating system in your system. The binaries which you produce falling out of your compiler will already have everything you need to interface with your devices and manage your tasks, do your scheduling. This can be all part of your programming language and can be created by your compilers. You don't necessarily always need to have an operating system there. Also in your cars or in your devices, in your embedded devices everywhere, this is also a common approach. If your device is simply small enough that your language could run them directly, if your language is already a concurrent multitasking language itself, then you can create it by the language without any further operating system around it. This is what is known as bare metal execution, as opposed to running on top of an operating system. Any questions on that? So this is the minimum stuff which you should find in an operating system. Now a little bit more typical. What are typical features of an operating system? Context switches. You can do that, remember? Asynchronous chapter, this lecture, We learned how to do context switch. That's a good part of process management in your operating system. Scheduling sometimes is, sometimes isn't part of your operating system. In many traditional operating systems, scheduling is an integral part of the operating system. In some more modular designs, you can put this as a user task, as something which is outside of the actual kernel. Just general administration of processes, creating processes, cleaning up after a process terminates, that should all be done by the process management of your operating system. Context switches, we have done that already. Sometimes you have actual hardware support for context switches. This is not the case for your specific CPU which you have. Here you just use interrupts to do that. Okay. And memory management, synchronization, and general hardware abstraction, a bunch of drivers. Memory management, you felt that quite painfully that on your little board you don't actually have memory management, right? You can define where you want to have your stuff located by just putting it there or allocating it on the stack, but you have to do it all by hand. You cannot just say, give me 500 bytes and then deallocate these 500 bytes again. You don't have these interfaces. An operating system would give you that and allocate that memory for you. Also, the features of virtual memory and memory protection is usually part of the operating system, as well as sharing memory between multiple tasks, that you can define which variables will actually be needing to be shared between different tasks. You can define that as well. Synchronization communication. Here you have these semaphores. That could be semaphores, which you have here to synchronize that. Could be other things as well. Sometimes you have not memory synchronization. Sometimes you only have message passing interfaces that you can pump data from one task to another. And your operating system helps you to do that. Sometimes that's called channels. If you're a Go programmer, they're called channels there. They're not necessarily translating into what your operating system does, but your operating system could provide those channels between tasks natively as part of the core service of your operating system. Hopefully, all of these synchronization and communication mechanisms are very tightly coupled with your scheduling mechanism, because scheduling becomes much more meaningful if you schedule something which can actually run, and not schedule something which is waiting for something to happen. And you could, as the operating system, know this didn't happen yet, so there's no point of activating this task. And that also means that all of these inter-process communication features are closely connected to scheduling. And then, of course, a whole bunch of hardware abstraction, device drivers, implementing the whole stack of network protocols. File systems is a big one here. Talk about file systems a little later again. Okay. No further questions on that. If you need to write an operating system, how can you go about that? What are the different options of that? The traditional approach is monolithic, which is a euphemism for a big mess. You just stuff everything in one gigantic, unprotected piece of code, and everything which happens in there will almost certainly crash the rest of your machine. This is utterly non-portable because it's just one gigantic mess, and obviously lacks reliability. Most early commercial operating systems have been designed exactly like that. This goes for all personal computer interfaces, operating systems from the early days up to round about the 2000s, where operating systems have been crashing a lot more than they do today. Today, we occasionally see what is called a kernel panic, which is usually pretty bad, and stops your machine, but you will admit that kernel panics, I hope at least, on your system is something you see fairly rarely. Maybe you have never seen this on your system. I hope you have never seen that. Back before the 2000s, this was daily, Brett, and you barely ever could get through a whole day of work without crashing your computer with one of these big monolithic operating systems and then pressing cold restart to get this thing back in control or not. So one step up from that is monolithic and a little bit modular, which means you have kernel modules, which you can load and unload, which have a little bit more flexibility to that. This is what current Linux versions are offering. Overall, it's still one weakness. There are no security from inside the Linux kernel. Linux kernel crashes, the roll rest goes down. And while the Linux kernel itself is, after 30 years of development, reasonably stable, it is still one monolithic block, and there is no hope on the horizon to ever restructure that system into something anywhere closer to more modern, because nobody would actually rock the boat for that anymore. How can you do this a bit more computer science-y? Well, you layer things, right? You abstract from one layer to the next one. And there was one operating system which was actually commercially used, which was called Solaris, which actually followed that fairly closely. And unfortunately, Solaris doesn't exist anymore. And there were plenty of academic operating systems produced at universities, which were following this much cleaner structure nicely. Problems with that is that you will almost certainly lose performance in that process, because if you have to go through five layers and five interfaces, you simply can imagine this translates into five function calls at least to do that, which means you need to pass a lot more parameters, and that will just slow your system down because you have to do this for every single interface call to your operating system. So they're a lot nicer designed, much more maintainable, but it will usually reduce performance here. So what do you have today? Today, the term microkernel is not a fashion term. It's actually something which is in existence and a good computer science concept to design current day operating systems. You are focusing on the core functionality of an operating system, the stuff which is never supposed to crash, the backbone of your machine, of your system, into a microkernel, and you reduce this functionality as much as possible. Take all the fluff out, all the stuff which is nice to have but not really necessary for operation, and you kick everything else out of the kernel. That gives you the possibility to run pretty much anything else outside the kernel. And if it crashes, it crashes. You restart that one. The kernel is not actually falling over, so your machine is not stopping. And you can still hopefully regain after some disasters which happen outside the kernel. Now, microkernel operating systems is not a new concept at all. A lot of quite old systems, like CPM even, or the old IBM VM 370 system, which comes actually from the late 70s, is technically a microkernel system, which can run a lot of other operating systems on top of them. And what you have today is in your Mac machine, in your Mac computer, you also have a machkernel plus a version of BSD Unix on top. And the machkernel is the stuff which is supposed to be highly reliable and high performant. Now, the microkernels themselves are very hardware dependent because they are super optimized for specific architectures. They are not built to be easily portable because they're very small and you have to actually recode them from scratch for new architectures. But they should be very reliable and very performant. Once you do that, you can also start treating the different interfaces on your operating system similar to user tasks. So you can do something like that. So a service like accessing the internet, accessing your graphics card, could be just a service task which runs on a similar level than your user tasks, and you access them via the microkernel. You transfer the operating system more into something which resembles a client-server structure than a hierarchical or monolithic operating system, which gives you a lot more flexibility. Then if an individual driver in individual service crashes, you just restart this service locally and the whole rest of your system is not really affected by that. It gives you more flexibility. You can configure easier. You can maintain and develop more locally. This gives you more modularization in your system and overall more reliability because single points of failures are not bringing your system down anymore. Unless the single point of failure is in your kernel, which brings us to the famous kernel panic situation, which is the worst thing you can do today to your desktop operating system. So these systems are used in current operating systems, as you saw here. Mach kernel is used actually in client-facing operating systems. There are also research projects like the L4 microkernel, which has been mostly verified, logically verified, to be correct and reliable and dependable. So you can have microkernels these days which are high-performant and very dependable. Once you actually communicate via microkernel, you can pull another trick. You can distribute your microkernels and wire them all up via some kind of a fast or slow network. And then your services can begin to migrate. They can actually begin to live on other CPUs, and your user tasks don't necessarily even need to notice that. You can use services which are actually physically running on another CPU on a completely different computer, two aisles down in your supercomputer where you're currently living, and your client tasks are not necessarily aware of that. What does kernel mean? Kernel is simply a word here which expresses the bare basic minimum, the core functionality of your operating system, which is in the kernel of your operating system. Microkernel means you want to have this kernel as small as possible. This is the core functionality of your operating system. If you want to describe your operating system as some colorful menus are coming up, that's usually not the kernel, right? Interfacing with your memory, that's done in your kernel. Okay. Last thing I want to do before I talk about processes is to give you a little bit of what does Unix actually mean? You have heard the term Unix so often in your university career, and I've used it also quite a bit. What does it actually mean? It means a few things which define Unix systems. The first thing kind of will be surprising for you, a hierarchical file system. Yes, because systems before that actually didn't have a hierarchical file system. So which comes without saying today is, yes, they have a hierarchical file system. Now, nowadays, I think a hierarchical file system is more of a historical burden than a feature, because why are we still using hierarchical file system in 2021? Why are we not using fast databases to do the same thing? You still are confronted with this aggravating pain of putting your files into a specific spot of a hierarchical file system, while at the same time, well, this is something which actually has something to do with my course, with my learning, with my, this is also a picture, it's also this and that. So you would be tempted to actually put these files in a number of different spots. You cannot really decide, and you put it there, and you forget where you put it, and you have to search for it later on again. If you would have something more like a database interface where you can actually put your file somewhere and tag it for all the things it is supposed to be associated with, that'd be a lot more logical. But we are stuck with hierarchical file systems still for most of them. Then using everything as a file interface. All devices, everything, including the user, is a file. That's Linux or Unix interfaces. Everything ultimately is a file. That's nice because you know everything will be readable and writable like it would be a file, but some things actually aren't files, and it's a little bit of a pain to actually interact with the user as if it would be a file, or with a graphical interface as if it would be a file. It isn't. Yeah? Dynamic process creation via duplication, the famous fork command, if you have ever seen that one, a very weird way of creating tasks, which is still quite common and widespread in many systems under the hood these days, that you can only create new tasks by duplicating an existing one. Cloning an existing task. Sounds a bit weird, and it is, but this comes from the original Unix design. A choice of shells, so your command line interface can be variable depending on what your needs are, which was a new feature at the time, not too surprising today's anymore. Everything is based on a C API definition. Unix is all defined on C. Solaris is one of the classical ways of defining that, the so-called POSIX interface. All of that is defined exclusively on C. I know some attempts to define this for other languages have been done, but ultimately this is all a C interface, which has significant downsides because no types, no exceptions. Relatively high degree of portability because it's also usually written in macroassembly, namely C. Has this been successful? Looks like it, doesn't it? This is all the stuff which is basically Unix systems today, and there is a ton of it. And some of it is dead, some of it is very alive and kicking. In all kinds of environments, you have this in the real-time world, in the embedded world, in the desktop world, you have Unix systems going through a lot of operating systems these days. I'm not saying all systems are Unix-based, many are. And so it's good to have some idea what Unix definition or what Unix systems imply, what that means to be a Unix system. Do I have missed it? Which one would Windows 10 be classified these days? No, you didn't miss it. I didn't say it because that's interesting. It depends a little bit how you look at it. So Windows actually moved a lot closer to a microkernel, but it depends a little bit how you look at it and how much information you take into consideration here. It is certainly quite a bit away from the monolithic mess which it was in the past, so there is significant improvements on that system, definitely in terms of reliability and structure, which you can definitely feel and experience if you compare this to what you had 20 years ago. So it's not an easy answer to do that. So it's not a clear-cut system. Again, this is the microkernel, but it is pretty close to a microkernel system these days. All right. Surprisingly, by the way, Windows also has some scheduling and timing constraints which you can throw at it, similar to what you have in some interfaces in macOS. You have the ability to express time as part of your scheduling requirements. Doesn't make it a real-time operating system, very far from it, don't get me wrong, but consideration of time and throughput has been sinking into the desktop operating systems to quite some degree by now. Not so much in Linux, but definitely in Windows and macOS. Sorry, I didn't want to discuss just desktop operating systems here. We're a little bit more core basics here than just talking about desktop machines. Because, as we said, operating systems exist in many other environments as well, and most of your CPUs are actually working somewhere completely different and not on your desktop. So if you want to understand what an operating system is, just don't just look at your laptops. Don't look at just the commercial systems in front of you. There are many other systems which are interesting for you to have some awareness of. So, any further questions to our first take on operating systems? Well, I will introduce you to process management and basics of scheduling on Wednesday. Anything still open here? I hope I triggered some curiosity about operating systems and where you can actually spend your time in the future besides just implementing web interfaces. There are many other interesting applications where computer scientists are very desperately needed. Okay, enjoy your assignment. And no, you don't have your assignment this week, sorry. Enjoy your labs, because it's actually a quite important lab. And your assignment comes next week, your last assignment for this course. Cheers. Thank you.